fiscal on this, and I think in order for us to make good public policy, we need to have all the financial information, and we believe it would cost less money, but I'd like to see the number crunchers tell us that it would cost less money, and we could proceed on that basis. So I would move that we refer this to the Ways and Means Committee without a recommendation, because we don't know the cost at this time.
Representative Canolfo has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, would a clerk call the roll?
Representative Winter?
Aye.
Representative Taylor?
No.
Representative Piercy?
Aye.
Representative Morse?
Excuse me.
Representative Lehman?
Aye.
Representative Hummel?
Aye.
Representative Snow?
Aye.
Representative Close?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 3246, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and it is on its way to Ways and Means. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3264. Okay. Now I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2010.
Which one?
2010. Around to County Code.
And a date note.
Yeah, Jana, would you give a little brief overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2010 allows the pharmacist, pharmacy owner, or pharmacy operator to refuse to fill a particular type of prescription on ethical or religious grounds. And if you recall, we've had a hearing on this on April the 1st, and there was quite a bit of discussion about conscience and the right of refusal of pharmacists versus the impact on people that want to get their prescriptions filled. There are amendments to the bill that are attached to your staff measure summary, -1, 2, and 3. And, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure other people here that, yes, I think Tom Holder is here that will walk us through those.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Holt. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. For purposes of this bill, I also represent the Oregon Society of Health Systems Pharmacists, and between our two organizations, we include most of the pharmacists in the state. The amendments you have before you, the dash ones, as far as I know, are not on the table. Those were brought to the previous hearing, I believe, by some other parties, and you all should have in your folder a memo I circulated to you all a few days ago on the dash 2 amendments. The difference between the dash 2 and the dash 3, and I'll leave it to the committee's discretion as to what you wish to do, is whether or not we include the pharmacy in the bill. I'd like to walk you through then what the dash 2s do. It significantly narrows the bill from when we last discussed it. First, it narrows the scope of the prescriptions to three types of things. Originally, the bill was quite broad and said a pharmacist could object to anything, and there were some legitimate concerns about that. And so we narrowed it down to those things that our members were most concerned about. And those are prescriptions under the Death with Dignity Act, emergency contraception. This is a fairly new therapy authorized by the FDA just last year. Toward the end of last year, it is referred to as post-coital contraception in the on page 1, lines 9 and 10 of the dash 2s. And the so-called morning after pill, such as RU486, which is coming onto the market later this year, and that's described as medications to terminate intrauterine pregnancy. That description is intended to make clear that we are not do not want to allow anyone to have an objection to medications that are often used for for the termination of ectopic pregnancies. These are the three things that drove us to bring this bill to you to begin with. They are things that are new to the marketplace, new to our practitioners, and raise some obvious issues in terms of people potentially having to choose between their most deeply held values and meeting the patient's need. The second thing that we have added to the really substantive thing that we've added to the bill, we have attempted to provide some guidance to employers and to pharmacists about the things that they can or cannot be asked to do. And we, by definition, have drawn a distinction between active referral and passive measures. What the bill would do is say that an employer could tell a pharmacist, look, even if you have an objection, you must give the patient the means to fulfill their legal prescription by, for example, and it's named in the amendments, providing a list of pharmacies or pharmacists who might fill the prescription for them, a dispensing physician. A dispensing physician is a person who has a license from the Board of Medical Examiners to dispense prescription drugs, or to call someone who is on call for the purpose of pinch hitting on these types of prescriptions. So at the same time, we've also drawn a line of limited things that pharmacists could not be asked to do if they have an objection. And we call that active referral, and that would be, you know, seeing all the way through the process and holding them through the process to ensure that someone has actually had it filled, which would be it'd be fairly unusual for a pharmacist to do that in any case, for any medication, to walk all the way through the process and confirm that it's been filled. So what we've tried to do here is draw some compromise and to give some clear direction of what employers still could clearly tell a pharmacist that they must do, because patient care under our professional ethical guidelines ultimately must be seen to. The patient must be given the means to fulfill their legal prescriptions. We've also added two other things for clarity. One, the original bill said that the pharmacist would need to state in writing. We've added also twice verbally. So a pharmacist could not send a memo off to bureaucratic Never Land, wherever they work, and say that I have fulfilled my obligation. No, they have to have a conversation about this with their supervisor. And that is one of the key goals of the bill to begin with. We want people to have an opportunity without fear of retribution to work out these issues with their employers. They're very real things to the individual practitioners and need to be dealt with in a careful way. So by doing this, we require a conversation to take place. If a pharmacist does not do the things named in this bill of noting their objection in writing, and they do not also have a conversation about it with their supervisor, then they have no protection, and that's a very important point. We want these issues to be out on the table between the pharmacists and their employers. And finally, we've added a provision mainly in response to some of Representative Lehman's questions in the previous hearing, where we say clearly that a pharmacist could be disciplined or dismissed for reasons other than declaring a conscientious objection. So if someone is consistently, say, showing up at noon when they should be there at 9, they can still be fired. We think with these changes, the bill is significantly narrowed and deals with the central issues that are of concern to our members. Now, the only difference between the dash 2s and the dash 3s, as I mentioned, is that in the dash 3s, we do not include the pharmacy owner or operator as someone who could object. There were originally some protections in the bill in terms of there being no penalties from administrative authorities and so on to a pharmacy if as an organization they chose not to fill these types of prescriptions. Now, I do note that on line 7 of the dash 3s, we would need to strike the words "or pharmacy operator" to finish the job that we thought we had done with the dash 3s. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions.
Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Holt, looking through your, if I understand what you've done, you've specifically limited those types of medications for which you have conscious objection up in Section 2, but you've left in Subsection 3, which now becomes Subsection 4, and you've not changed that in terms of for what basis an employee can refuse to fill a subscription. That's still very broad in Subsection 3. In fact, what you end up with is Subsection, but now it was 3, now becomes 4, and your new Subsection 5 become inconsistent.
Chair Cruz, Representative Lehman, the guidance that we had from Legislative Council was that those changes would handle that problem, particularly because we have made the distinctions in the definition of what a person can and cannot be asked to do.
Well, if maybe I'm missing something here, but if I read it,
following your question,
subsection, looking at the original bill, subsection 3, which looking at the amendments, I don't see that being taken out. Subsection 3 states that a pharmacist refused to fill, et cetera, a particular type of prescription with no limitation. They cannot, and has stated a conscientious objection. The employer of the pharmacist may not discharge, discipline, discriminate, or retaliate against. Very broad exclusion. Then you go down to your new paragraph 5, and you say nothing in this section prohibits an employer from disciplining or discharging a pharmacist who has an employee for reasons other than the pharmacist's notification. So I guess I don't know, those two are inconsistent maybe, but certainly it's not limited in the old subsection 3 to these medications you've limited up above.
Chair Cruz, Representative Lehman, I would note that we have added in line 14 or actively refer, and so it goes back to the scope described up above. That would be,
Mr. Chairman,
our intent.
Again, if you look at the old subsection 3, which becomes 4,
mm-hmm.
and you insert the language in there that you're talking about, mm-hmm. it still does not limit it to death with dignity and the contraceptions you've listed above.
Chair Cruz, Representative Lehman, all I can answer to that is that council told us that when we inserted the new 2 above that we would be taking care of that problem. I'd be happy to strike language as necessary to resolve any conflict that you may see. The solution there might actually be to right. I'd like to do that further consideration. Chair Cruz, Representative Lehman, we could insert conceptually under the words I believe under this act on after the word prescription on line 15.
Can you repeat that?
Pardon me?
Can you repeat that?
If we inserted the words under this act, under this 1999 act on line 15 after the word prescription, that would be clear in limiting it to what's mentioned above in the bill.
Are you in the dash 2s, Mr. Holt?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I'm referring on line 15, the original bill.
The original bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That may correct that particular issue.
Second.
Thank you. Mr. Holt, now the field's been narrowed to just three areas, assisted suicide, emergency contraceptive pill, and the RU 486. My understanding, the Board of Pharmacy has rules, has drafted rules regarding the assisted suicide and the opt-out that that bill called for. Also, my understanding, emergency contraceptive pill is a double dose of your regular birth control pills. Take two pills instead of one. So we get, for me, that gets it down to RU 486, which isn't even yet approved. I question the need for this, actually, and I guess am not convinced that it's needed, given that if you're an independent pharmacist, you can choose to fill prescriptions or not. If you're working for a company, we've heard testimony that those companies have policies that allow you to opt out. And so I guess I still am not convinced of the need for the legislation here, or whether we should be saying it's okay for a pharmacist to not fill a legal prescription. I don't feel much differently about that than I do about the state trooper in Washington who took a couple who had violated traffic violation and were on their way to an abortion clinic. He took them to his church for counseling and lost his job subsequently. I can't believe that the pharmacists as a whole in this state are supportive of this kind of action when it's already available to them. Could you just speak to that, why it's needed?
Chair Cruz, Representative Taylor, yes, I'd be happy to speak to those issues. One, in terms of the Death with Dignity Act, I think this does simply bring more clarity to the language we have. We have implicit in rule of the Board of Medical Examiners the potential to opt out, and I say implicit, it's not explicit. There's a procedure by which those types of prescriptions are handled, whereby the physician is first to contact a pharmacy, and it's implied then that the pharmacy would have the opportunity to opt out. In terms of the other medications, what we are attempting to be proactive. The emergency contraception is a fairly new, newly approved therapy. It was approved by the FDA just last fall, and we're anticipating that before too much longer that is going to be distributed in its own packaging. In terms of the RU 486, our information is that the FDA plans to grant approval to allow manufacture and marketing of that in the U.S. later this year. So we are attempting in some respect to get ahead of the curve. I would have to take some exception to comparing this to the Troopers incident, which made infamous headlines. Our goal here is to avoid that very type of confrontation by requiring a pharmacist, if they want to have the protections of this bill, they have to speak up first to their supervisor and work out some means to work around this type of a situation. If they don't do that, then they can, and in my view, should be disciplined if they were to, you know, to get in some kind of a confrontation with a patient over one of these things. Our whole goal here is to avoid that type of a situation from coming up. We admit this is a difficult issue for some folks, and I'd say there is a clash of rights, the right of the patient to obtain legal medications versus the individual rights of those relatively, I think, small number of pharmacists who would find a deep enough objection to not want to fill one of these types of prescriptions, and you know, and that, and but these, and I would simply add that even though it's we believe it's you know, it's probably not the overwhelming majority of practitioners who would I would not think that the overwhelming majority of our practitioners would routinely object to this types of thing. This legislation is supported by the boards of directors of both our organizations. We've discussed it extensively with our members, and even those even many of those members who say, you know, I would have no problem with this, have said, you know, look, we do understand our colleagues' needs, and we're trying to help alleviate that situation.
Thank you. I just want to follow up, Representative Kidd. I wasn't aware of the opt-out policy that existed, and you're saying that you the need for this to be proactive. Doesn't part of this take place in your bargaining contracts? Those decisions of whether or not a person may or may not have to fill a prescription. Give me some insight as to what discussions take place.
Chair Cruz, Representative Winters, we would hope that that would always be the case, that someone could work that out in advance as they're hired on an employer. Unfortunately, if all the policies were clear and if all of our members were being treated with the level of professional and individual dignity that we think they deserve, then we wouldn't be here asking for this bill. You know, in an ideal world, yeah, these would be worked out without there being this specific kind of mandate. I wouldn't say it's a mandate, but there is a fear among some of our practitioners that if they do speak up and attempt to work out these things, that then they could suffer professionally, and we don't think that's right. We want people to be able to discuss these issues and put them on the table in an open way. And that's really what the bill does, is by requiring that the pharmacists speak up first, they have to discuss the issue before they get any protection.
So it's my understanding that there is a pharmacist conscience clause already in the Death with Dignity Act, and that also it's been readdressed in another bill this session. I'd like you to comment on that, if that's true. And how does this, and if we do this, how is it going to affect the work that's already been done on this issue?
Chair Cruz, Representative Piercy, in terms of the Death with Dignity Act, there is a rule of the Board of Medical Examiners which states that in the cases where a physician does not wish to dispense the medications directly, they can, with the patient's consent, contact a pharmacy. And then it is implicit at that point, not explicit, that the pharmacist may opt out at that point. That rule is currently incorporated in Senate Bill 491, which has cleared the Senate, I believe, and has just been assigned to civil law. But we, I guess I would simply make two points there. One, we certainly, as legislative counsel reminds us from time to time, we cannot assume the passage of one bill, another bill, when crafting our own. And so that's one reason why we've incorporated it here. We also thought that it would have seemed rather odd to not include one of the three things that are of great concern to our members in the bill, and perhaps then implicitly making some kind of a statement that they are not entitled to any kind of opt-out under that act.
My comment would be that there's very few people in this body that would tell you that a rule is implicit and not explicit.
Chair Cruz, Representative Piercy, the reason I say it's implicit is the language of the rule is not explicit. It does not say in the rule the pharmacist may opt out. Those words are not there. It goes through a step-by-step process, and one can imply by reading the rule, and that's the intent.
But if I may, it's there for that purpose to say that. Is that not true?
Chair Cruz, Representative Piercy, not having been around for the drafting of that particular rule, I couldn't speak to that question.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, if I heard you right, and I'm just trying to clarify in my own mind, for the right of the pharmacist to be able to say, I object, and twice verbally and then in writing to say, I object, I don't want to fill those kind of prescriptions, please find somebody else, whatever the case may be, but then the responsibility that they have is to actively try to refer a patient that's seeking whatever medication it is that the pharmacist objects to, of the three, by the way, that's their responsibility, is to actively refer, to actively try to find a way for the patient to be able to get their prescription filled. Am I understanding that correctly?
Chair Cruz, Representative Cromwell, very close. The responsibility of the pharmacist is to provide the patient with some means to fill their prescription. Now, we have drawn a distinction between what we call actively refer and more passive measures. They could be required to do what we describe as passive. Some people may view as active, but we're trying to come up with some terminology here. But they could be required to provide a person with for example, a list of places where they could get the prescription filled if there's not another pharmacist right there able to fill it. They could be required to call a person who was on call for that purpose. Things of that nature. They would not necessarily be required to walk the person all the way through call of the, we specifically talk about calling the pharmacy to make sure that the patient ultimately got it filled. That would be a highly unusual thing in any event. And so we are drawing some distinction there, but in the short answer to your question is yes, the pharmacist would have some responsibility here to see that the patient can obtain their legal prescription.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. I understand where this is, you know, where you're trying to go with this. I'm still struggling with the contract law aspects of it, and whether or not this is going to have whether or not this would be deemed, you know, if a court were to look at it, would it be deemed unconstitutional because it violates contract law, or would it even if it's not in violation of contract law, what the relationship that it sets up with the between an employer and an employee. I think a person that owns their own pharmacy, I don't have a problem with it. They can just choose not to stock the drug, and then that way they don't have to deal with it. They can just say, I don't stock that particular medication or those medications. But a person that works for, you know, another pharmacist, the relationship that exists between employer and employee, I'm having a problem with that.
Chair Cruz, Representative Cromwell, in the context of the Pharmacy Practice Act, there are a number of professional standards that are set, and we would view this as one more. For example, a pharmacist is required to counsel with the patient, regardless of what their employer may wish them to do or nudge them toward doing or not doing. They must do it. A pharmacist is similarly required, for example, to report knowledge of possible violations of the Act standards, which certainly could be contrary to an employer's interests. So in that sense, we think it's consistent with the rest of the Practices Act and speaks more to a professional standard than any other issue.
If I understand this correctly, an employee pharmacist could say, I have a conscientious objection let's use the contraceptive objection to doing the contraceptives, and I will not fill those prescriptions. And the employer pharmacist cannot say, this, I disagree with you, I can't do this for everybody, I have a conscientious objection to picking and choosing what prescriptions we could fill, but could take no action based on that against the employee. Is that correct?
Chair Cruz, Representative Crummell, or Representative Lehman, I'm sorry. That would be, I believe that would be accurate.
Mr. Chairman, taking that one step further, small pharmacy, rural Oregon. Employer hires on a pharmacist to take off his load, can't work the law that's required anymore. Employee comes on and says, a month into the employment, says, by the way, I don't do these prescriptions. The employer couldn't say, this isn't going to work because I can't take off on my 30 days of vacation or 2 weeks of vacation because you won't fill some of these prescriptions. But there's no way that that pharmacist could then get rid of that employee to bring in somebody who would fulfill his needs as an employer and a business owner.
Chair Cruz, Representative Crummell, the exact type of situation that you describe is one we would hope would not arise as the bill directs people to have a conversation about these types of issues, and one would think that simply by professional standard that a practitioner would discuss such a thing on coming aboard. People do change their minds about such things, of course, as time goes on. So there's no, you know, there are no guarantees. At some level, I think we have to trust people to treat each other with some respect and dignity, and that goes both ways in this bill. The employer has to be treated with some respect by the practitioner, and the practitioner needs to be treated with respect as well.
Mr. Chairman, so this is essentially an effort to legislate respect and dignity?
Chair Cruz, Representative Lehman, if you choose to interpret it that way, I suppose.
I'm in trouble if you let a lawyer ask me a question. Representative Christie.
Well, I guess the problem that brings up to me in this discussion is if this is about respect and dignity, that we should not have to legislate, then it seems to me that the current practice should suffice of employers working with employees to work out those issues without us having to legislate.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. We have had testimony that someone was fired because they did have this conscientious objection. We have a tradition in this country, in the military, of honoring people's freedom of conscience. So I think it is appropriate for us to legislate this if people are losing their jobs because of it. We heard testimony from Fred Meyer as well that although they do allow them to offer a freedom of conscience clause, that they do reserve the right to fire them for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Employment process. So, Tom, if I were the owner of a pharmacy, which I'm glad I'm not, but if I were, and now I'm taking applications for a pharmacist, can I make it a part of my employment process to offer the pharmacist a conscientious objection form if they say, yeah, nothing bothers me, and then come back a month later? Can I then say, hey, I offered this to you, you declined it, and now you'll do as the rules of the pharmacy are, or seek employment somewhere else? Or am I kind of, even though I offered them, I mean, first of all, can I offer them that? Is that going to be illegal, or will there be a legal challenge on that? And if I do offer it to them and they don't sign it and they come back later and decide they are, then do I have any recourse, or am I kind of stuck?
Chair Cruz, Representative Crummell, I think what you've described there would be one innovative way to resolve this type of issue under the bill.
Thank you. Just to clarify, my remembrance of the last time we heard this bill was that the person who lost his job, when we asked him if this bill would remedy his issues, the answer was no, it would not.
Representative Morse.
Thank you. Tom, I have the same type of question. As I remember the last hearing, we heard from the pharmacist from Fred Meyers who lost his job, and then we heard from the vice president of pharmacies who said that he didn't lose a job because he refused to fill, but that he refused to pass it on to somebody else to fill. That was the reason he lost his job. That's what I remember. Now, does this bill require that the pharmacist who has an objection must pass it on to someone else to fill? I just want to be sure.
Chair Cruz, Representative Morissette, in answer to your question one, I believe the testimony in the previous hearing from Mr. Miller spoke to the bill as printed, and the bill as printed did not speak to the issue of referral. We have amended it
right.
to speak to that, and the amendments do require, or I should say they don't necessarily require, but they allow the employer to require that a patient be provided with means to fill their prescription, such as a list or calling someone who's on call.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Representative Lehman.
Chairman, taking the modification of employment law a little further, could I, as a pharmacist in hiring someone, ask them if, in fact, they're going to have any problem fulfilling his prescriptions and elect not to hire someone because they say I may have a problem with that?
Chair Cruz, Representative Lehman, the bill, is, as I read it, is silent as to that issue.
Mr. Chairman, if I hired someone on who's expressly said to me, I will have no problem with those prescriptions, and I signed a contract with them that said they are more than willing to give those prescriptions, and 6 months into the contract, they decide, well, let's put it, 4 months into the contract, we have salary negotiations, I don't give them a raise. 6 months into the contract, they decide they have problems fulfilling these prescriptions. Could I then terminate them under the employment contract, or will the law supersede that?
Chair Cruz, Representative Lehman, that's an interesting hypothetical. Not being a lawyer, I'm not sure I could fully answer that. My initial reaction to it is that if a person makes a promise in writing, they apply to stick to it.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at your dash two amendments, as you were talking to us, it was actively reserved. And in that, you describe the measures taken to ensure that a prescription is ultimately filled by another pharmacist. And then ultimately, what kind of timeline? Let's say that you were taking them the morning after. Is that, and you're in a rural area, and that's the only pharmacist. And you've got 72 hours on that particular issue. So what does the pharmacist do to get someone to fill that prescription?
The Chair Cruz, Representative Winters, and that would be an instance where the practitioner would have some obligation under our ethical standards to provide person with reference to another perhaps another pharmacy, or to call someone who's on call to where they could get it filled.
But if that's the only pharmacist in town, we're talking a rural area now.
Chair Cruz, Representative Winters, for purposes unrelated to this bill, we happened recently to map out where pharmacies are located in the state, and it's our belief that the worst case here would be a short drive of perhaps a half hour to 45 minutes at most in the most far-flung areas of the state. Just a point of information related to this, we have quite a bit of anecdotal information that in Washington State, where pharmacists are allowed to directly dispense the emergency contraception without there being a prescription. People are coming from as far away as Eugene to have those types of prescriptions filled north of the border in Washington, where they can get it directly from a pharmacy without going to a doctor. I think that speaks somewhat to the determination of people to find places where they can get them filled, and that's without there being any kind of a formal mechanism in place for people to know where to go. So we certainly are sympathetic to that issue and kept that in mind in drafting our amendments, and was one of the reasons we wanted specifically to note the possibility of providing a list of places to go. There is another solution also, of course, that we point to in the amendments, just by reference, that for a lot of these types of things, it would be very appropriate for a physician to dispense these things directly. No one can get any of these medications in the state of Oregon without first having a prescription from a physician or a nurse practitioner, or a physician assistant in some cases.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to have the committee stand up just for a few minutes.